Welcome back. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Abigail Marsh, an associate professor in the Department of Psychology and the Interdisciplinary Neuroscience Program at Georgetown University, she was in a car accident that could have killed her if it wasn't for a man who risked his life running across four lanes of traffic to save her, a complete stranger. This whole experience left her shaken and wondering about the science behind altruistic behavior. She began investigating how the brain responds to others' fear and the links between that and the extremes of generosity and cruelty humans are capable of. The results are fully explored in her book, The Fear Factor: How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. It is published by Basic Books, and I'm pleased it brings Professor, or is it Dr., Abigail Marsh to our show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So is it professor or doctor? I want to get it right.
Or both. Either. You're welcome to call me Abby.
Okay, fine, Abby. So you've described the hero who saved you from that car accident as the doppelganger of the actor Idris Elba. Tell us about the car accident that took place when you were just 19 and this Idris Elba lookalike who rescued you.
Yes, in the dark, at least wearing sunglasses, as I recall, he did look quite a bit like Idris Elba. Lucky me. And so what happened is I was driving home on this major freeway from Seattle to Tacoma, and as I was crossing an overpass, a dog ran out in front of my car. And like almost anybody would do, I swerved to avoid it, which you're not supposed to do. I know now. And my car spun out and stranded me in the fast lane. And then the motor died of my car. So I spent seconds or minutes being certain that I was about to be obliterated by one of the cars or trucks rolling by until a stranger appeared at the passenger side window and offered to help. And he got me back to safety, asked if I was going to be all right, and then he just disappeared again.
Never heard from him again.
I never heard from him again. He didn't tell me his name. I have no way of getting in contact with him. I would love to meet him one day, but I don't know if it'll ever happen.
Now, you've said the whole experience shook you. Is that what led to your specific research on the part of the brain that inspires someone to act so heroically?
Yeah, it's one thing, I think, to know that people do save other people's lives. We've all read stories about that happening in the paper or whatever, but I think it's something different when it happens to you personally. The sort of awe-inspiring magnitude of a decision like that is incredible when it is so real, and it really gnawed at me trying to understand why somebody would make a decision like that.
Did you remember to say thank you to Idris?
You know, I was so shaken up. I don't think I did. Not that that's an excuse. That gnaws at me today also.
But it would strike me that that would be something that is actually common. That in the moment, you don't remember to say thank you.
I imagine it would be. There was so much crashing around in my brain at that moment that, you know, being polite was probably
that's the least of your worries.
On the list.
So, Abby, where does the human capacity to care for others come from? I mean, are we born with a short supply of it in some cases while others have an abundance of it?
That is almost certainly true. People vary a lot in terms of their altruistic capacities, and there's pretty good evidence that it's at least in part genetically mediated. Nothing is completely genetic, but there's probably an influence of genetics. And then life experiences add to that as we develop. But certainly the capacity for altruism is inherent in humans as a species. We have to have it because we have to provide this incredibly intensive care for our children as they grow up. So we need that capacity to care in general. Mm-hmm. And then in some, you know, rare extreme populations of people, that capacity is so big and expanded out so far that they'll provide care even at risk to themselves for people they've never met before.
In the whole debate of, and you sort of alluded to this, whether biology or not, I mean, to your mind, is it nature or is it nurture or is it an even combination of the two that determines the level of caring for others, of altruism in someone?
It's got to be a combination of the two. I often ask the people I work with who are extraordinarily altruistic, they've all given kidneys away to strangers, you know, why it is that they think that they have done this very rare thing. And some of them will say, well, you know, my parents raised me to care about other people, which I'm sure is true. And I'll often ask them then if they have siblings and if any of their siblings are unusually altruistic or have donated a kidney. And almost all of them say, well, no. I guess I was just listening differently, or I guess I just took the message differently. And I think that's a beautiful illustration of how no matter what things happen to you in your life, innate qualities to you as a person affect the way that those messages influence you.
Mm-hmm. So you in the, I think, in the prologue, not the dedication, in the prologue to your book, you have this quote from Charles Darwin's The Descent of Man. And it reads, and I've read it like three times now, and I'm still trying to get it, but it is extremely doubtful whether the offspring of the more sympathetic and benevolent parents or of those which were the most faithful to their comrades would be reared in greater number than the children of selfish or treacherous parents of the same tribe. He who was ready to sacrifice his life, as many a savage has been, rather than betray his comrades, would often leave no offspring to inherit this noble nature. Okay, well, what's he talking about?
It's amazing how scientists used to write in those days.
I know.
Now we write, you know, four-word long sentences. So he's basically talking about the idea of survival of the fittest,
right,
and the idea that people who are willing to sacrifice their own welfare for strangers would be, in theory, less likely to leave any offspring and to propagate future generations.
Right, they should have died out long ago.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at survival of the fittest very narrowly, it's sort of hard to understand why people would sacrifice their life for a stranger.
And so then why haven't they died out?
So this is a question that we are still in the process of answering. But I think, again, the idea comes back to the fact that people are born with the capacity to care for others. Again, just because we're mammals, because we have these incredibly vulnerable offspring, we have in place ancient, powerful neural architecture that gives us the capacity to notice when young, vulnerable people are in distress and to be motivated to provide care for them. And because variation is an intrinsic part of being a living thing, some people are born with and develop less of that capacity. And then on the other end, there are some people that develop a lot of that capacity. And there are probably useful things about being a caring, compassionate person within a social species. And so there are almost certainly advantages to being that way as well.
All right. Aren't most people motivated by their own self-interest so that even when they do kind acts, it isn't inspired by charitable impulses so much as feeding their own self-perception or image within their community? Or am I being too cynical?
If you listen to economists, then that's true, right? And many people do. Economists sort of take that as a given, that self-interest is, you know, quote, rational, and it is the overpowering and maybe only real motivation. But if you look at the way the human brain is set up, it's not necessarily true. We have multiple different parts of our brain that are all active at the same time, many of which are looking out for our own very narrowly defined self-interest at any given moment. But there's pretty good evidence that people do place inherent value on the welfare of other people as well, that we literally resonate with their internal states and possibly value their welfare just the same way we value our own. And we all have that experience for our children. You know, most people would say that they value their children's welfare as much or more than their own. And so that's possible. Then in theory, it's possible to have that kind of valuation for a much wider circle of others.
So what's the definition of altruism that you've used in your research? And do we know if there are differences in the brains of altruistic people?
Yeah, so altruism is any behavior that is intended to benefit the welfare of somebody other than the altruist. And if you want to be really stringent about it, you can define altruism as a behavior that's costly to the altruist. So they have to really make a sacrifice in order to help somebody else. And what we found, looking at a population of people who were extraordinarily altruistic because they gave a kidney away to a stranger, which is a really costly sacrifice, that their brains are different from ordinary people. There's a region of the brain called the amygdala, which is known to be involved in emotional and social processes, that is bigger in extraordinary altruists and is also more reactive to the sight of other people who are in distress, in particular, who are experiencing fear.
So how much research had been done on the brain's relationship to altruistic behavior since Darwin's theories of 150 years ago?
Well, Not a whole lot, I would say. One of the difficulties is measuring altruism in the lab, because, of course, when you ask people to behave altruistically in the lab, they know that you're measuring them. They know you're watching and keeping track of what they're doing. And so it's hard to separate out really altruistic motives from motives like social desirability and adhering to norms and things. And that really, I think, hamstrung research on altruism for quite a while.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with psychologist Abigail Marsh on how one emotion connects altruists, psychopaths, and everyone in between. And you can see us Thursday, December 21st at noon when we're broadcasting live from the Green Space. Join us as we celebrate the holidays with jazz pianist Bill Charlap, who will perform Christmas favorites. Plus, Grammy Award-winning mezzo-soprano Susan Graham talks about her starring role in The Merry Widow at the Metropolitan Opera, along with her co-star, tenor Paul Groves. And New York Times columnist and cookbook author Melissa Clark will be there with tips for making delicious holiday gifts, and she'll take your questions. Get your tickets now at thegreenspace.org. This is WNYC, and WNYC.org will be right back after a break.
WNYC supporters include Paul Winter, presenting his 38th annual Winter Solstice Celebration, December 14th through 16th at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. Tickets at 866-811-4111 or solsticeconcert.com. The Nature Conservancy, dedicated to conserving nature so that nature and humanity can thrive. The Nature Conservancy, the world we depend on depends on us. Learn more at nature.org/New York. Williams, building upon its commitment to support New York communities through development grants to local nonprofit organizations. Williams, we make energy happen. More at williams.com/WNYC.
Life is full of questions.
Like, is it ever okay to tell a lie?
What makes a real friend?
How can you tell if an elephant is really happy?
On Pickle, one of the new kid shows from WNYC,
we ask tough questions
and figure them out together by riding a runaway subway train.
Dispatcher, can you hear us?
And we travel back in time to ancient Rome. Explore life's trickiest questions on Pickle. Find it at WNYCKids.org.
This is WNYC, 93.9 FM and AM 820, NPR News and the New York Conversation.
Today on Fresh Air, three members of the band Ranky Tanky, which performs contemporary versions of songs from the Gullah tradition of the Georgia and South Carolina Sea Islands. They'll talk with Terry Gross and perform in studio. That's today at 2 on 93.9 FM. And we're back. Welcome back. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Jonathan Capehart, speaking with Abigail Marsh. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology and the Interdisciplinary Neuroscience Program at Georgetown University. And she's the author of The Fear Factor, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. Abby, because you told me I could call you Abby. Welcome back.
Thanks very much.
So while doing your research at Harvard, you made a discovery that would lead to more breakthroughs, and it's about how our brains respond to fear. Is there a difference in how someone who is altruistic responds to fear?
Yeah, there really is. We found, and we're a little bit surprised initially to find in the laboratory, that people who behave altruistically in the lab, giving money or volunteering time to help a stranger, are better at recognizing when other people are feeling afraid. When they look at their facial expression of fear, they're better able to just say, that person's afraid.
Interesting. And so then, how do you measure a person's response to fear?
Well, that's one way to measure it. And you can also measure physiological responses. Do they respond emotionally with, their hands sweating or their heart beating faster? And you can also measure their brain. Does the amygdala, for example, show more activity in response to that expression?
And so is the response to fear the best indicator we have of someone's capacity for altruism?
You know, it seems to be. If you're looking at individual differences in how compassionate people are, how well people respond to fear is just about the most reliable indicator that there is.
Mm-hmm. And now you talk about my friend and the New Jersey Senator Cory Booker and his own heroic act of saving his neighbor's daughter, Zena, from a fire. Tell us the story.
It's an amazing story. Then Mayor Booker was coming home one afternoon with his security. And when they came home, he realized his neighbor's house was on fire, and his neighbor was outside shouting that her daughter was trapped inside the home. And he reports that he responded almost instantaneously, ran into the house despite his security detail begging him not to. He eventually had to fight them off in order to plunge further into the house through the fire, find his neighbor who was semi-conscious on her bed, and then pick her up, put her on her shoulders, and carry her back out of the house, down the stairs with embers raining down on him, black smoke filling his lungs until he collapsed on the lawn outside. It was a really unbelievable story.
Yeah, and I remember when that happened, and people initially were like, oh my God, what an incredible thing he did. And then almost immediately it was, how crazy must you be to literally run into a burning building like that?
Yeah, and people who take sacrifices to help other people often get called crazy.
Right.
I think because for many of us, it's really hard to imagine making that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so we assume that anybody who would make a decision like that is somehow irrational or crazy. It's
right.
A really common response.
So,
and people also assume that he just must be impervious to fear. There were amazing comments that people made about him. You know, that Cory Booker's not afraid of the dark. The dark is afraid of Cory Booker. But when he described how he was feeling during the incident, he said he was terrified.
Right. I mean, he described the absolute terror he experienced as the flames were engulfing him and the girl as he was trying to escape. Do we know what's going on in his brain when he plunged into that fire while all this is happening around him?
I mean, what I would give to have some actual direct measurement of what was happening in his brain at that moment is a lot. But we can take a guess based on what we know of human and animal research. Again, there's this part of the brain called the amygdala that responds to other people's distress. So, for example, his neighbor screaming in terror out on the lawn that her daughter was trapped in the fire. And what seems to make the difference in people who are very altruistic is not that they don't recognize the threat of the situation, but that they move toward the source of the danger rather than running away from it to protect themselves. It's amazing.
So contrary to the movies where we see people running through burning buildings or space stations or what have you, and they seem so calm and fearless, that's bunk.
Yeah, that's not actually how people who do these things in real life report having felt in the moment. They just reported that some motivation greater than fear was driving them.
Mm-hmm. So instead of beginning your research by studying altruistic people, this blows my mind. This blew my mind. You began with the opposite. You began with psychopaths. What's the definition of a psychopath?
So a psychopath is formally an adult, and I study children, and so we say that they are psychopathic or have psychopathic traits. But a psychopath is an adult who is sort of clinically lacking in any sort of sensitivity or caring about other people's suffering or distress. They lack empathy, they lack remorse, and they tend to engage in a lot of behaviors that cause other people suffering as a result.
So you say clinically, but is there a genetic disorder? Is it a genetic disorder that causes one to be a psychopath?
Well, looking across big populations, it seems, again, like genetics account for 50%, maybe a little bit more, of the variation in psychopathic traits. So, yeah, there's almost certainly some genetic component to psychopathy, although, again, it's not exclusively genetic. You're not hardwired to be a psychopath, but there are risks that seem to be present at birth in some kids.
Oh, that's interesting. Such as?
Well, we know that children who are born to parents who are have very callous dispositions themselves and who also are very fearless, interestingly, those children are more likely to be at risk for developing psychopathy later on.
Wow. There's a previous interview that we did with a filmmaker that kind of reminds me of this. Well, I'm not going to call anybody a psychopath. So what's interesting, you brought this up earlier at the beginning of the interview, but you found studying twins has been a good way to understand how much being a psychopath is nature versus nurture and or involves other variables. What do twin studies tell us?
Well, twin studies tell us that if one identical twin is highly psychopathic, there's a very good chance, not a perfect chance, but a good chance that the other identical twin will be as well. Whereas if you're looking at fraternal twins, the correspondence between psychopathy in the twins is lower. And when you see a pattern like that, it's a good sign that there is a genetic basis to whatever it is you're looking at. And we see similar patterns in disorders like schizophrenia and autism and bipolar disorder. They're all similar that way.
Interesting. And you also write about what can be learned from studying twins or siblings who are raised by biological parents versus adoptive ones. What do those studies tell us?
Well, those studies tell us that we as parents, I don't know if you have children, but I do, we as parents should have a certain degree of humility about the role that we play in our children's lives. And I would be the last person to say that being a good parent doesn't matter. It does. For children to grow up feeling loved and being cared for is incredibly important. But the way that parents treat their children often don't have very predictable effects on the way that their children turn out. Mm. And particularly, they don't seem to have very predictable effects on how compassionate versus callous their children are. The effects of sort of which parents raised a child are actually pretty limited in that way. It's not to say that life experiences don't matter. They definitely do. But specific things that parents are doing, we've had trouble making that link. It's interesting.
So that makes me wonder about, you know, parents trying to, you know, handle their kids, you know, the whole system of rewards and punishments. How much do rewards and punishments determine behavior?
Well, they certainly determine behavior in whatever context you're in, and especially rewards do. And, you know, this is advice I give parents of all children, whether those children are a little bit on the callous end or whether they're typical children, is that kids and really everybody respond better to rewards. And if you set up your environment so that the child is rewarded only when they're doing the things they're supposed to be doing, in general, their behavior will get better.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway?
Yeah, so he and a number of other serial killers are from my hometown of Tacoma, Washington. I don't know what it is in the water there.
I was going to say, like you said, a number of serial killers.
Yeah, Ted Bundy, the DC sniper, quite a few prolific killers came from Tacoma. So he may have been the most prolific serial killer in American history. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly. But he killed a large number of women, many of them sex workers, in and around the Tacoma and Seattle area in the 80s and 90s. And he was certainly extremely psychopathic. So the FBI profiler, Mary Ellen O'Toole, who interviewed him extensively, said he's just about the most psychopathic killer that she's ever interviewed.
I mean, did he ever describe how he came to be so violent?
Well, here's the problem with interviewing people who are psychopathic is that they one of the criteria for being a psychopath is that you're a very good liar and you're a good manipulator and you like to present yourself in a good light or at least an advantageous light. And in addition to that, there's always the problem of insight. You know, how well do any of us really understand why we came to be the particular way that we are? So he described elements of his upbringing and, you know, the things that he did as time went on. But nothing in his background is so out of the ordinary that it could sort of help us understand why he went on to engage in these horrific crimes that he did.
Mm-hmm. In the little time that we have left, real quickly, Amber, who at 14, you write in the book, at 14 could boast of killing her guinea pig, threatening to burn down her home, and seducing men in exchange for gifts. She used the tools she had available to get what she wanted, like all children, but unlike other children, she didn't care about the damage she inflicted. Were her parents afraid of her?
Oh, yeah, I was, too. I mean, not when we were in the lab, but she's the only kid I ever worked with who I wouldn't have spent a night alone in a house with. Absolutely. They were terrified of her.
Wow. And so what kind of treatment is available for a child like Amber, so devoid of empathy?
Well, this is the really sort of pessimistic note, is that there isn't much. When these children do cause serious damage or commit crimes, obviously they get put in detention, and sometimes there's treatment available there, but often not. And there really is no great, consistently effective treatment that we have yet for children who have serious conduct problems and psychopathic traits. We're still working on it. We need a lot more resources poured into this problem.
Is there some kind of tell that would help us avoid psychopaths?
Well, not really, and certainly not when you're first meeting somebody. And, you know, I've always said that I could line up all the children I worked with who were very psychopathic and mix them in with all the healthy kids I've worked with, and I dare anybody to try to pick out who was who.
They come out as quote-unquote normal.
Yeah, absolutely. They seem extremely normal, sometimes super normal when you first meet them, often very friendly and personable and very enjoyable to spend time with. I really actually enjoy working with them. The way that you tell who they are is looking for patterns of behavior. So if you notice that somebody seems to engage in a lot of behavior that uses other people, they manipulate people, and they don't seem to care when their behavior causes bad consequences mm-hmm. for others, that's when you know what you're dealing with.
I've been speaking with psychologist Abigail Marsh on how one emotion connects altruists, psychopaths, and everyone in between. Abigail Marsh, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.